This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome back to a new season of Radio EcoShock as terrible 2020 unfolds. Later, we ask UK climate scientist Chris Smith whether the COVID-19 shutdown will help or hurt the climate. But first, this.
6 degrees of climate emergency.
What will happen if Earth warms 2 degrees, or even hotter? People turn to a key book by British author and climate activist Mark Lynas. In 2007, Mark published the book 6 degrees, Our Future on a Hotter Planet. But there's been a lot of science since then, with more serious risks and warnings of climate catastrophe in the making. We need Mark Lynas to pour through masses of science papers, conferences, the whole fire hose of new information, so he can update the big picture. That is just what he has done. The new book now out is Our Final Warning, 6 degrees of Climate Emergency. Mark Lynas, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. Nice to be back.
Your first 6 degree book became a standard. National Geographic turned it into a full-length documentary in 2008. Why not just rest on that?
Well, because 2008 is now a long time ago, and a lot of people have been contacting me over the years asking what's new in the climate science and really seeking to answer the question of whether things are getting worse or whether we're making progress and whether I'm more optimistic or more pessimistic given what the science has thrown up in the intervening years. So to answer that question in a what I consider to be a fully rigorous way, I actually needed to go back and kind of repeat the original exercise of surveying the scientific literature, which, you know, took the best part of 3 years and essentially piecing together what then became a new book in the same format as the old one.
And as before, you turn each degree of warming into a chapter of previews of the future derived from science. And I almost immediately skipped to the end chapter to 6 degrees of warming. And I did it not because I believe that is our inevitable future of doom, but because I find it highly unlikely we will go extinct anytime soon. What did you find in the scientific literature about the course of life with 6 degrees of warming?
Actually, very little, which is one of the most shocking things, perhaps, is that given 6 degrees has been part of the sort of envelope of potential futures for a long time now, 20 years probably, in terms of the computer models, there's been very little work done by the scientific community actually trying to put together a picture of what life on this Earth would be like if it was 6 degrees hotter. So for most of the information I'm using, I have to go back to look at the geological data back tens of millions of years to previous times, such as during the dinosaurs era and so on, when the Earth was 6 or more degrees hotter than it is now, and there was no ice on the planet, and it was a completely different kind of Earth to the one that we've been used to. And also to answer the question of what, as you hint, what runaway global warming would look like, what would it take to actually drive the human species extinct, which is a question, again, which is very difficult to answer, but one which I thought was worth spending a bit of time on, given how important it is.
Yeah, it's unreal. In 2009, European scientists organized that 4 degrees and beyond international climate conference. That was at Oxford. And 2 years later, there was a follow-up conference in Australia, 4 degrees or more. I covered speeches from both. But that seemed to be the end of it. And you found practically no one investigating what 6 degrees of warming would be like, even though it is remotely possible, but possible, we could go there.
Yeah, and it's possible given a confluence of two different events, if you like. So one is that we're unlucky and that the Earth turns out to be more sensitive to greenhouse gases than you might hope. And the second is that we're extremely stupid and that we continue increasing our fossil fuel consumption for several decades to come. If those two things come together, then the 6 degree outcome becomes much more likely. And even as we stand, you know, I think it's a lot more likely than, let's say, an airplane crashes when you when you go on a flight, which of course is something that's, you know, at the back of everyone's mind when they go on a plane. It's much more likely even now that we'd see a 6 degrees warming on planet Earth. So I also often find it kind of odd in the way that we assess risk as human beings, in that we kind of ignore and dismiss risks to the planet, but risks to ourselves as individuals we take much, much more seriously, even if they're like a 1 in a million chance. I think it's much more likely than 1 in a million that we could see 6 degrees of warming this century.
Yes, we seem more concerned about the risks to major banks or things like that than we do with the future of the planet. So as you point out in the book, scientists have discovered periods when Earth was far hotter than 6 degrees C compared to pre-industrial times. How hot has it been, and would you talk about one of those periods?
Well, what we need to look at in the geological history isn't so much periods of sustained hotter temperatures, which have happened in the Jurassic and the Cretaceous for tens of millions of years because life became adapted to those. Actually, what we're doing now is turning up the thermostat by several degrees in the space of less than a century. And geologically, that's unprecedented, probably even compared to the major mass extinctions which have been on this Earth, which are often also related to rapid global warming, but doing it at an order of magnitude faster than has ever happened before, even in the worst mass extinctions. So the experiment we're carrying out now with the planetary biosphere is probably unparalleled, even in comparison with all of the geological data we can find for the last half billion years, so really since complex life evolved.
And of all the mass extinction events known to science, given the rate we're doing it, what do you think is the closest to our warming predicament now?
Probably the closest is the mass extinction at the end of the Permian period, about 252 million years ago, which coincidentally was the worst mass extinction ever to affect life on Earth. So upwards of 90% of all of the species disappeared at that time. And there's lots of ways, actually, in which it's coincident with what we're seeing now. Probably the driver was that there were volcanic intrusions. Huge, huge areas of what's now Siberia saw volcanic magma intrude into coal seams. So basically it was a massive fossil fuel burning event. Even so, it took place 10 to 100 times more slowly than we're currently doing, but it was severe and sustained enough to, as I say, wipe out the majority of life on Earth and lead to a very different planet from the one that precedes it.
Just recently in the news, firefighters managed to save the 2,000-year-old redwoods in California from the wildfires, including a 329-foot-tall monster known as Mother of the Forest. In your book, you write about times of mass extinctions when world forests burned, lighting up the night sky. Is it possible we've already reached a level of warming when forests will no longer survive in Southern California?
Well, I'm actually extremely concerned about the fate of forests, not just in Southern California, but around the world. Forests are becoming very drought-stressed. There's a lot of new invasive diseases which are wiping out whole tree species in different regions. And also insect attacks, such as the bark beetles, which are wiping out many of the pine forests that you've got in the western half of the United States and elsewhere. So it's a very difficult time for trees and forests as a whole. Some of the forests are fire-adapted. Redwood seeds come out when they have fires touching them, but not the kind of mega blazes that we're seeing now. So the problem is that most forests simply aren't adapted to the kinds of conflagrations and the huge wildfires, which are now becoming more and more common due to this kind of joint incidence of both droughts and much drier and increasingly hotter temperatures as well, both as a result of global warming.
Mark, I worry this system of measuring global warming by degrees may be misleading the public. 2 degrees of warming does not sound like much, and if people think that means every day is just 2 degrees warmer than the same day in years past, so what? But scientists are talking about the global mean average temperature, and that includes this giant pool of the ocean. Temperatures on land, I hear, will be much hotter with a lot more variation, meaning more extreme weather. Would you agree that this official degree system is understating reality, and what do you expect with 2 degrees of warming?
Yeah, that's why I devoted a whole chapter to what these 1, 2, 3, 4 degree averages actually mean. The difference between 1.5 and 2 degrees, to give you just one example, is the difference between half of the coral reefs still surviving and more than 99% of coral reefs disappearing. So essentially the extinction of a whole biome across all of the planet's tropical regions. So that's the kind of difference that you can get in just half a degree. I also don't think there's much prospect of from 2 degrees and upwards of us being able to produce enough food to feed humanity. And if you get to the 3, 4 degrees, as you correctly say, it doesn't sound like much on average, but by that point, we'll be making substantial areas of the planet uninhabitable to humans. You simply wouldn't be able to function outside biologically because it would be too hot in the hottest parts of the year. Much of the southern U.S., I mean, we've just seen heat records in Death Valley. Most of the southern states of the U.S. will be facing what are currently Death Valley temperatures for long periods of the summer. So that just gives you some insight into what we mean in these very broad brush averages in terms of the actual extreme heat that we would be facing across large areas of the planet.
I hear a few bleak voices suggest we will reach 5 degrees of warming by the end of this century, but the majority of scientists I interview do not think that. Many still talk as though 2 degrees is a realistic target. I don't agree with that myself. Another large group sadly suggests the most realistic outcome is 3 degrees of warming by 2100 or maybe 2150. Mark, do you think there is a majority view among climate scientists about what we might hit by 2100?
Well, I don't think this has to be a guessing game. The key determinant on the temperature outcome is the emissions trajectory. So what matters is how much coal, oil, and gas we continue to burn over the subsequent decades from now. No climate scientist can tell you that, nor can anyone else. It's as much dependent on who people vote for in elections, you know, what people buy, which companies people support, the whole sort of infrastructure of modern industrial civilization, which is currently fossil-fueled, whether that can be transformed into being supported by cleaner energy sources. So, as I say, that's anyone's guess. I don't think a climate scientist can give you any more informed view than any person in the street.
You know that humans watch what happens on the land. That's the way we're equipped. We don't see under the ocean waves. Do you, in your book, cover what could be developing in the seas as we warm up degree by degree?
Yeah, that's a huge issue, actually, because most of the heat that's being captured on the planet now isn't sitting in the atmosphere. It's going into the oceans. The oceans, you know, water has a much, much higher thermal mass than air does. So all the heat's really in the oceans. I think it adds up to about Hiroshima atomic bombs worth of heat every 3 seconds, you know, which is a huge, huge amount of heat, which is then going into the oceans. And we're seeing more and more of these ocean heat waves, essentially, which are driving species into new areas and also threatening and wiping out coral reefs and other ecosystems. So the oceans aren't going to be protected. And potentially, if you look at the mass extinction scenarios, the oceans have less oxygen in, they stop overturning as much, they don't move heat around. The whole system basically shifts into a different gear from the one that we've experienced, for millions of years on this planet.
Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. Our guest from the UK is author and climate activist Mark Lynas. We're talking about 6 degrees of climate emergency in his new book, Our Final Warning. When looking for an ultimate kill weapon that can develop really quickly, possibly within the lifetimes of some listeners, we reach for methane hydrates. The Arctic Methane Emergency Group is focused on this. Mark, what are your views on the methane hydrate risk?
I think it's probably been somewhat overplayed in terms of methane hydrates from subsea reservoirs. Remember, you've got to heat the oceans right down to the bottom, even though these are fairly shallow continental shelves. All the same, it takes a lot to get a feedback between global warming and release of methane, and leading to more warming and then more release of methane. That takes decades, possibly centuries. I'm much more concerned in the near term about the thawing of the Arctic permafrost on land, which is already very well underway, and a lot of additional carbon, both methane and carbon dioxide, can be released as a result of that in just a few short years to decades. And with 2 degrees of warming or 3 degrees, we would lose pretty much all of the Arctic permafrost and the Arctic sea ice as well. And there's a feedback there where you've got less of the bright white ice reflecting the sun's heat in the summer from the Arctic Ocean. So there's other feedbacks which I think they maybe sound less apocalyptic, but they're certainly more real in terms of their likely near to medium terms impacts.
But we do seem to get strangely excited about total doom. People make movies about it. The Bible describes the end times. I think a more realistic and near-term problem is this. At what level of warming does civilization collapse to a point where no organized effort can be mounted to do something to save a livable climate? Do we know when that point of becoming sort of helpless witnesses on the road to hell could come?
Well, that's obviously the big question, you know, when we see a sort of Mad Max-type future. I mean, civilization is already under strain in different ways. You know, I think you can quite plausibly argue that democracy is under strain now around the world from the rise of right-wing populists, from Trump, Bolsonaro, Duterte in the Philippines, and many others. So is that a kind of civilizational collapse? Certainly it's a potential shift in the way that the world has been for, you know, since the Second World War. It's not to do with resource constraints or arguably with global warming, but, you know, as the impacts of those begin to accelerate more and put more strain, and you see more refugees, for example, that could lead to the rise of more extremist groups as well. So it's the way that you get the kind of interaction between the physical impacts of climate change leading into the economic and then into the political, which is really going to put the stresses on civilization. And that's very difficult to tease out, and it's very difficult also to predict in advance. It's not something you can feed into climate models like you can feed in physical equations of how the climate operates with clouds and the oceans and rainfall and all that kind of stuff. How human societies will react is a much more open question. And so, yes, you can be gloom and doom about it, or you can be relatively optimistic. I think both those perspectives are viable. I'm increasingly of the gloom persuasion. If you get above 2 degrees, I think you've really got to focus in on coming under 2 degrees as a global target, as indeed was agreed in Paris in 2015. So we've got to not let go of that as still a viable outcome.
You mentioned the risks of thawing permafrost, which I believe is beginning to develop, and the Arctic sea ice is very low this year. We don't know. It would take a storm to actually push most of it out of there, but it's weak. So we have to avoid these big, big changes happening in the Arctic. But Mark, I believe you oppose geoengineering to cool the planet. Why?
I'm not ideologically opposed to it in forever and for all time under all circumstances. I just think it's probably our worst near-term option. There's much better things we can do to reduce the accumulation of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So that's our critical short-term objective. And we shouldn't lose sight of that. And we shouldn't start to be persuaded, I think, that there are other options like putting geoengineering, like putting sulfur aerosols into the stratosphere. And if we want to kind of transform our planet into essentially an artificial creation, then that's the direction we want to head down. I'd prefer to restore the opportunity for natural processes to keep our planet habitable. I think you can argue it scientifically both ways. So for me, this is as much a values issue as anything, but I don't want to see a planet where we artificially engineer the weather. You know, for me, you could potentially save life, but in some ways you lose some part of your soul if you do that.
In your new book, you write, quote, "The most important issue facing us today in comparing our own future with the hothouse worlds of the Cretaceous is not so much the magnitude of warming as the rate at which it occurs," end quote. And that is what keeps many of my scientific guests awake at night. Why is the rapid rate of human-induced warming so important?
The speed of warming is so important because the rate at which ecosystems can adapt is dependent on that. So if you warm the planet by a couple of degrees over a million years, that's very different to warming the planet by a couple of degrees over a century, which is geologically unprecedented outside of the mass extinctions that we've seen over hundreds of millions of years this is. So if you wanted to cause another mass extinction on the planet, probably the clearest and most reliable way to do it would be to do what we're currently doing, which is to heat up the planet by several degrees in a very, very short space of time, which is probably geologically unprecedented. I can't find any evidence in the whole of the last half billion years of an event which heated up the planet by several degrees in less than 100 years, or where greenhouse gases, even from the largest cataclysmic volcanic eruptions, where they didn't add greenhouse gases to the atmosphere at the rate that we're currently doing, as this very popular species digging up fossil fuels and burning it at, you know, millions of different sources all around the world 24 hours a day.
Yes, as we speak, there are probably people in boardrooms and talking to investors about going to drill all over the Arctic and all the places in the deep ocean we haven't been yet. Let's bring out more and more fossil fuels. What do you think needs to happen to that big wealth engine of fossil fuels, and how fast does it need to happen?
Well, it needs to be confined to history, and so we need a complete technical transformation to cleaner energy sources. You know, there's social movements out there which are pushing for divestment in fossil fuels. I think those are really politically important because they essentially remove the social license to operate of the big fossil fuel companies, and it becomes like tobacco or arms. You know, people just don't want to put money in, or slavery even. You know, if you were to take a parallel from a couple of hundred years ago, that you essentially want these industries to cease to exist. They're not compatible with a livable planet. And so there's lots of different ways that we all have to collaborate in doing that. I think political targets are also really important. Just saying, like in the UK at the moment, we've more or less given up burning coal altogether. They'll stop selling new internal combustion engine cars in probably 15 years, which means that everything has to go electric. So all these signals need to be sent by government. And so essentially you need to have a party in power which is committed to a program of rapid shift away from the fossil fuel economy.
As you surveyed the literature, were there indications of a temperature point of warming where we might expect mass starvation?
I think above 3 degrees were theoretical of food shortages globally, which is something that's got worse in the scientific literature since I did the first book. Then I think scientists were fairly confident that actually, there would even be increases in food production in some parts of the world with a couple of degrees of warming. I don't see that anymore with the increase in heat waves and drought. I think we're already close to the peak of what's climatically possible in terms of production in current farmland. So it's really quite a dire prospect trying to feed, well, what would be, what, 8, 9 billion people in mid-century in a 2 degrees plus warmer scenario. That's, I think, when you start looking at really horrific scenarios of, you know, mass famine and climate refugees and, you know, starvation really on an unprecedented scale.
You know, when I started this radio program in 2006, like you, I almost assumed that once the public had access to the truth about climate change, we would act as a society to prevent the worst outcomes. How do you feel about that now?
Well, that was before the age of Trump. I used to kind of blindly assume that we were an intelligent species. And, you know, if you informed enough people, people would get mobilized. People would vote for politicians who took the problem seriously. I didn't envisage a situation where, I mean, to take the U.S. example, the entire Republican Party would have climate denial as an article of faith as part of its political DNA. So it's kind of astonishing, really, if you look at this from a rational perspective, why you would have a political program which denies the probably the most serious threat to life on Earth, denies its even existence, then you can't, of course, fix it. So maybe we're not as smart as I thought on a collective sense. A lot of people are smart, and we have all the technologies that we need at our fingertips probably to enact this shift, but somehow the politics is getting in the way, and that's not something I would have foreseen back in, 2007.
And Mark Linus, I have to tell you that here in North America, climate activism seems stunned almost into silence, not quite, by a drift towards dictatorship that you talk about and more immediate problems like racial murders by authorities and a rampaging pandemic. What is happening in the UK or Europe with climate activism these days?
Well, it's similarly, things have gone quite quiet. You know, there was a big upsurge with Greta Thunberg's Fridays for Future movement, the school strikes, and also with Extinction Rebellion, which began in the UK and had a lot of impact around the world. You know, brought London to a standstill on several occasions, and there were, you know, the political impacts of that were quite profound. In the UK, we had a net zero target, which was then adopted for 2050. It should be earlier, but still, that's very important to have in law. There was climate emergency bills passed in Parliament and things. So it actually seemed like there was a huge amount of momentum in the direction of climate activism, which I think was dissipated by COVID-19. Obviously, you couldn't have people on the streets anymore, and it just, you know, shifted everything in a different direction. It's possible, I think, to still get some good out of this and to have COVID-19 recovery pointing in a more climate-friendly direction. But at the moment, I'm not particularly optimistic that that's kind of the trend. And it really depends, I think, so much depends globally on November the 3rd. Actually, I think that's probably a tipping point as important as anything that's happening in the Arctic, is which way the U.S. votes in November, and whether we get another 4 years of Trump. I don't think democracy in the U.S. will survive that, and I think in some ways that'll be kind of a death knell for kind of rational collective behavior to try and save the planet as well. That heralds a new era, really, of anti-democratic, authoritarian, but also anti-scientific politics, which is not going to be just restricted to the U.S. It'll be elsewhere as well. And, it'll be very difficult to come back from that.
There is a traditional saying, hardship is a door opening. In a blog post at marklinus.org, you suggest COVID-19 and the shutdown could be a horrible way, granted, to realize that we can save ourselves from catastrophic climate change. How has our reaction to the pandemic raised at least some hopes in you?
Well, I mean, give us some credit, I suppose, as a species that we've pooled our resources internationally to try and achieve a vaccine. No other species facing a pandemic can have the intelligence and the wherewithal to do that. And I'm fairly confident there will be a vaccine becoming more widely available probably by the end of this year. So we should be able to get out of this. Then the question is how we kind of focus on kind of economic recovery, if anything. And if we're going to pour trillions of dollars investment to try and get the economies around the world back on track, then that should surely go into a kind of green growth where we're moving to clean energy and shifting off the fossil fuel treadmill. It is an opportunity to do that when you've got huge amounts of public money that needs to be spent. And jobs is central to that, getting people back to work. And doing that as part of a transition to a cleaner economy. So it's certainly possible, but these things will only happen if you've got a conducive political environment with a sensible government that actually believes in solving these problems rather than denying they exist in the first place.
Is your new book, Our Final Warning, out in North America or just in Europe?
It's out in the United States, Canada, so North America, out in the UK as well, and we've got different, I think there's a Dutch edition which is now out as well, and we've got different languages, Germany and other places, which are currently in production.
Great. It's going to be worldwide. We have been speaking with author and activist Mark Linus. His new book, Our Final Warning, 6 Degrees of Climate Emergency, is out now, chock full of science and possible futures. Mark, thank you for talking with us.
Thanks, Alex. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
The 2020 summer climate was frightening. Northern Siberia and the Arctic Circle experienced tropical temperatures. At the start of September, Arctic sea ice was near record lows. Japan went through a deadly heat wave, while China struggled with massive river floods threatening the Three Gorges Dam. You know California and the whole western United States were burning with record heat, drought, and horrifying wildfires. One of the hottest temperatures ever recorded, 130 degrees Fahrenheit or 54 C, was measured in California's Death Valley. Hurricane activity is up, with the double system slamming the American Gulf Coast, and that had surges of waves up to 20 feet high. Various citizen scientists feared sudden heat if the layer of cooling smog disappeared. But what could stop industrial civilization and all those cars, planes, and boats? We found out with the COVID-19 pandemic. But was the strange weather in the Northern Hemisphere really related to the shutdown, or is this just the new unnormal as we force Earth into a hotter state with everyday emissions? A world expert will answer those questions and more coming right up. When the pandemic struck the world in 2020, business, travel, and institutions shut down to limit the spread. That meant a sudden reduction in global warming gases many thought would be impossible. But was it enough to derail the developing climate nightmare? Not really, says a new study from UK and European Union scientists. But how we manage to recover could either speed up or delay the great warming. Do we go back to normal, or do we change to lower emissions? Our guest is uniquely qualified to answer this puzzle. Dr. Chris Smith is a research fellow for the Institute for Climate and Atmospheric Science at the University of Leeds. Chris is also deeply involved in a project called Constrained Consortium to investigate primary climate unknowns. Chris Smith, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Chris, you are co-author of a new paper in Nature Climate Change, Current and Future Global Climate Impacts Resulting from COVID-19. To me, COVID and climate seem like big game changers that interact. Is that what you studied here?
Yes. So obviously, COVID-19 and climate change are both huge issues for humanity. And there is increasing research looking at the links between the two problems. But the difference here really is a matter of timescale. So COVID-19 came upon us really, really quickly. And we've seen sort of huge changes around the world to how we live our lives and how society has operated since the pandemic began. Now, climate change, as I'm sure you're all aware, has been an ongoing an increasingly urgent problem for the last 30 or 40 years, or at least that's how long scientists have known about it. So climate change is the slow kind of ongoing crisis, and COVID-19 is a very rapidly developing one. But the solutions to both actually have a lot in common. And we've seen from the global response to COVID-19 that society can actually change very quickly in terms of making big transitions to our way of life. Now, obviously, this wasn't necessarily a good thing, or at least it wasn't sort of set out to be a very positive change. But we have seen some actual benefits from lockdowns around the world. So one of them that we often talk about is the improvement in air quality caused from a reduction in air pollution because of a reduction in travel and industrial activity. And this is one of the things that we looked at in our study and applied this to what it might do to the climate over the next few years.
Well, looking at a graphic in the paper, we see a dramatic cliff fall in a range of climate-changing gases starting in March 2020 or thereabouts. But the most dramatic are for lesser drivers, it seems to me, like black carbon and various nitrogen compounds. The really big players, carbon dioxide and methane, they don't drop anywhere near as fast or as far. Why do you think that is?
Well, there's a number of reasons. So it depends what the main sources of emissions of these gases are. So for things like black carbon and nitrates that you mentioned, one of the main sources of emissions from those are road transport. And as we've seen from our analysis, where we actually looked at mobility data from Google and Apple, so we had sort of a big data set of mobile phone or cell phone data telling us where people were moving and actually seeing how much that changed over the first half of 2020, we could actually really sort of notice that these shorter-term pollutants were really sort of going off a cliff. In terms of carbon dioxide and methane, the reductions were a bit smaller. So methane mostly is from agriculture. And even though we travelled less throughout the lockdown, people we obviously all still need to eat. So the methane sources didn't really go down that much. As for carbon dioxide, this has sort of so transport is only one small sector. So things like energy production from coal power plants and other sources of carbon dioxide were still being produced, just at a slightly lesser rate than they were before the lockdown started.
Even though some research expeditions and ships may be grounded temporarily by COVID-19, scientists are finding this giant fire hose of data just waiting to be collected and understood. It's wild that even mobile phone data can tell us about disease spread and even emissions and the climate. Chris, when do you think this kind of data will get further out of the corporate holding pens and into the latest climate models, and how well does information from Google and Apple match what climate models say themselves?
Well, we really hope that this is a kind of a precedent for this kind of data to be used more widely.
because COVID-19 was so unprecedented, we don't really have a good idea of how this data would actually play into the really state-of-the-art climate models that are run by the meteorological associations around the world. But what we sort of can do is, like I said, we can use this data to sort of back up other sources. So we also used information from remote sensing from satellites, so we can determine what's happening to these nitrogen oxide emissions from afar and correlate that to our mobility data. So what we actually did here is, rather than use sort of a very sort of state-of-the-art complex model, we used a more simple model that is sort of replicates the behavior of these very complex computational models. And that's what we used to produce our projections of global temperature for the next 10 years.
Some people worry that young people are not doing enough on climate science and activism. You're not one of the old guys, one of the older professors, but one of your co-authors is barely out of high school. Could you tell us just a bit about Harriet Forster and her dad, the lead author?
Yeah, so Harriet, she's 18. It was actually mostly her idea. So when the lockdown started, so obviously school children around the world have been affected. Some have not been able to complete their exams, and so this has been a very big problem actually in the UK. So the exams are actually really messed up, and it's affected a lot of people. So I mean, it's probably helped that she has a climate scientist as a father, but. This is a really good example of when someone can come up with a good idea, such as looking at mobile phone data and then applying it to a tangible problem such as climate change. Now, obviously, there's a big team on the paper, and we've all sort of worked together to produce this research. But it all started with a good idea from an 18-year-old. So it kind of shows that sort of anybody can produce good research with good ideas.
And based on your research, news outlets report massive pandemic changes, like people staying home, will not really change the future climate all that much. Please help us understand what your team found.
Yes. So you've kind of touched on it already with the fact that some emissions like CO2, which is the main greenhouse gas, haven't changed as much as some of the shorter-lived air pollutants. And there's a couple of reasons why the climate impact won't be that big just from the COVID-19 lockdown. The first one is that CO2 has a long atmospheric lifetime. So the emissions that we've produced over the last few years will be around for a long time. The second one is that some of the air pollution that we've emitted or has been reduced over the lockdown period actually has a cooling effect. So if we reduce CO2 emissions and we reduce air pollution at the same time, they offset each other in a climate sense. So the actual net effect is quite small. Those two reasons together, really, plus the fact that the change in CO2 particularly wasn't actually that big, are the main reasons why we won't see a big climate impact, if any, from the actual lockdown period itself. But what we do want to emphasize is that this can be the basis for kickstarting a green recovery. We've seen how quickly society can change in the face of a global pandemic. And as I said right at the beginning, climate change has been a problem for 30 or 40 years, and very sort of comparatively little action has been taken on it. And then suddenly this big global crisis comes along, and we can change society overnight pretty much. So we actually do have the tools to actually kickstart a greener future. It's just whether now there's the societal and political appetite to do so. So I'm kind of cautiously optimistic that people have seen what a sort of lower air pollution future looks like, and I hope that people will take that on board and really sort of fight for it.
You talked about the side effect of cleaner air, and some people did worry that with the COVID shutdown, we could see a rapid warming once that cooling layer of smog or pollution dropped and the full sun power was revealed. Is that possible? Do you think a small smog-free warming happened in any important way?
I don't personally know. So this is actually an area that I've studied before, where we looked at the sort of combined reduction of CO2 and air pollution. And so the good news is that you don't get a rapid increase in warming when you do reduce both CO2 and air pollution at the same time. So actually, there's a combined benefit of air quality and climate from this reduction in CO2 and air pollution at the same time. So hopefully this also strengthens that previous message that was part of my previous work.
Sounds like the biggest greenhouse gas impact we could hope for from the shutdown might be around the equivalent of 2 parts per million less greenhouse gases than expected in a couple of years. But global CO2 levels have been increasing by about 3 parts per million in recent years. What did you find here?
So again, this is related to the long atmospheric lifetime of CO2 and the fact that on long time scales, about 50% of what's emitted remains in the atmosphere for a very long time. So even though the rate of CO2 emissions have slowed down, CO2 will continue to accumulate in the atmosphere. So the parts per million of CO2 that we observe will continue to increase. Just it might be at a slightly slower rate than it would have done without the lockdown. The interesting thing for us to determine over the next few months and few years as scientists is whether that change is detectable and whether the various CO2 monitoring stations around the world, whether there's any regional diversity in how the CO2 measurements come about. So, for example, the majority of emissions are in the Northern Hemisphere. So it'd be interesting to see whether a reduction is seen first at somewhere like Mauna Loa, Hawaii, which is the longest monitoring station compared to Antarctica, whether those time frames of CO2 changes are different in different places. And that might also help us understand a bit more about carbon dynamics as well.
This new paper in Nature Climate Change suggests the real thing to watch for could be local appearances of extreme weather, and that made me think of the unnatural rains in China recently and the blistering record heat in the American Southwest. How could our reaction to the pandemic enhance extreme weather events?
Yeah, again, this is related to some previous work that I was involved in. And this is when we sort of change these regional patterns of air pollution, we can sort of induce sort of dynamic changes. So we can sort of change the weather patterns compared to what they would have been otherwise, because air pollution is quite regional in its distribution, whereas CO2 acts more on a global level. It would be pretty difficult to attribute any single event to the air pollution changes from lockdown. But this is another emerging topic in climate science. It's this kind of real-time event attribution. And we are seeing just unrelated to COVID-19, the number of extreme events increase around the world. So things like heat waves and floods. And that's completely expected in line with a warming climate. So in summary, it'd be quite hard to actually pinpoint COVID-19 as a cause for some of these extreme events. But again, this is an emerging area, and this will be very interesting to do further research on.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Dr. Chris Smith from the University of Leeds. We're talking about how the COVID-19 shutdown may affect climate change. Chris, let's talk about the pathways out of this mess. First of all, how long did your team estimate significant reductions in activities and emissions could continue?
Okay, so it seemed that there would be some level of global economic disruption from COVID-19 for about 2 years. So when we actually sort of wrote this paper, things were looking quite encouraging. But actually, this 2 year disruption actually seems to be about certainly until we have a widespread workable vaccine, possibly seems to be about correct. So we assumed a temporary 2 year drop in emissions. And then after that 2 years, we investigated a number of pathways out of this COVID-19 lockdown scenario. So one of them was just a return to where we would have been if there was no COVID-19. So basically on the trajectory of emissions that we were sort of at the end of 2019. So a kind of steady but slow increase in emissions. And then we also looked at a sort of a rapid recovery, so like an overshoot. So this is what happened after the global financial crisis, when actually the economic rebound was very fossil fuel driven. So we actually had an increase in emissions over where we would have been if there was no financial crisis or, in our assumptions, no lockdown. And then there's sort of two more optimistic scenarios where we assumed that this reduction in emissions would actually kickstart a green recovery. So these two scenarios, basically, the way out of COVID was not a fossil fuel developed way out of COVID. So we had some of the gains from the energy demand reduction that we saw during the lockdown period carried over into the recovery. And we looked at a fairly moderate recovery, which is consistent with a long-term 2 degrees scenario. And then we looked at a very ambitious recovery, which was more in line with a 1.5 degree Paris target scenario as well.
It surprised me in the paper that whether we come back with dirty emissions or a green path, it won't really make any difference until at least 2030. Why the big delay, Chris Smith? And would that not make any sacrifices for a green regrowth a harder sell?
Yes, it's understandable that, I suppose this is one of the one of the problems with communicating the climate emergency, is that any of the sacrifices that we make now won't pay off for a number of years. And this is a classic example, which is related to that balance between warming greenhouse gases and cooling air pollution. So when you change both at the same time, the results that you see aren't instant. There is actually sort of very little difference in the future pathways before 2030. It's after 2030 that we start to see in the green recovery pathways that impact of the emissions reductions that we make now manifesting themselves after 2030. So I certainly understand that it's one of the main problems with climate change communication or climate activism, if you will, is that it is very difficult to make people see the benefits of changing their behaviour now for some future payoff. But in terms of why this is kind of really important now is because things are starting to get pretty serious. So we're looking at sort of increasing climate damages with every tenth of a degree of warming. So the IPCC 1.5 degree special report pointed this out very well. So particular economic damages with increasing climate change, not to mention the sort of human and social costs as well. Even though sort of no immediate benefit is seen, the long-term benefits are certainly worthwhile action now.
I take issue with one assumption in the recent Nature paper. The authors assume the disease interruption to emissions is just temporary. What if we don't come back and, in fact, fall into a deeper depression where nobody can afford to go anywhere or buy much of anything? Isn't it possible that a prolonged economic collapse really could make a dent in our race to heat up the planet?
Yes. If there was this kind of sort of unsavory scenario of a very prolonged and deep economic recession, then providing that we didn't burn our way out of it in terms of fossil fuels, or at least have this really large, basically if we don't start burning coal because it's the cheapest thing we can find, then yes, there would be a more noticeable and it's a more noticeable immediate effect, possibly starting before 2030, because that reduction would be quicker. I think the evidence we've seen so far is sort of activity is remaining constant, maybe slightly increasing. As lockdowns have eased across the world, economies have not exactly rebounded, but they've kind of stopped free-falling. And I think we're probably not going to see, I mean, I'm not an economist, but we're probably not going to see this really severe, prolonged, sort of catastrophic recession. That would be my sort of non-specialist prediction from this. So I would probably argue that a very prolonged effect on the climate as a result of increasing restrictions is probably unlikely.
This is all so new. It seems like we all have to go back to school to learn about climate change. And while we have you here, Chris, two of your specialties rank among the phrases least understood by the public. Can you help us understand these two terms, radiative transfer and radiative forcing? What do those mean?
Right. Okay. So radiative transfer is a branch of physics which basically deals with how radiation from the sun interacts with the atmosphere and the Earth, and then also the radiation from the Earth. So that's emitted at a different wavelength, interacts with the atmosphere and clouds. And this is really the driving effect of the greenhouse effect that keeps the planet warm. So changes in atmospheric composition are what really drives climate change. So radiative transfer really is the study of radiation flowing through, I'm going to be specific, to the planet Earth, radiation flowing through the atmosphere and how it interacts with things like gases and air pollutants and clouds. So it's a really key component of any complex climate model. So they all have this radiative transfer code inside them, which govern how the sun's energy ultimately warms the climate, warms the planet. And what radiative forcing is the kind of the change in the energy that's kept inside the Earth. So it's what you do to the planet that causes climate change. So an example of radiative forcing would be the change in CO2 emissions since the start of the industrial era. So that effectively is an increase in the energy that's inside the Earth system. So what the Earth does to try and get rid of that extra energy is to warm up. So, I mean, that's a very kind of simplified sort of description of radiative forcing. But effectively, what we're doing is we're kind of kicking the system out of this equilibrium that it was in before the industrial era into a different equilibrium that will happen far in the future. So hopefully that was a sort of useful explanation of those two terms.
Definitely. I really appreciate that, because scientists like Dr. James Hansen and all the scientists talk about radiative forcing. And I know most of my listeners don't really grasp it at a human level. And I think you've just helped us do that. One other aside, if you will, you did your PhD on the interaction of solar energy with climate change. What sort of interactions did you find between solar power and climate?
Okay, so I was looking at how solar energy might be affected in the future under different climate scenarios. So one of the things with solar panels, the photovoltaic type, is they actually become less efficient with increasing temperatures. So this is something that we need to take into account when we're planning a future energy system. And it's not just solar energy that suffers from this, actually. So I recently found out that gas power is another one where the warmer it gets, the less efficient it becomes. So there's a possibility that you actually might need more power generating capacity to make the same level of power if our climate warms up. So these are kind of important decision-making. It's important knowledge for energy planning. So you actually know what kind of climate that you're going to be putting your energy infrastructure in for, given that most of these power plants have a 40-year or 50-year lifespan.
Well, even on a personal level, if you want to put solar power on your roof to run air conditioners when it's over 100 degrees Fahrenheit or over 35°C, you're going to have to put up more panels because they won't be quite as efficient when it's super hot out there.
Yeah, that's one possibility. I mean, whether that will be detectable at the sort of household level, I'm not sure. But on a country level, you would imagine that these efficiency declines could be a few percent. So we're talking significant amounts on a sort of a national or global scale. So yes, it was a sort of very interesting sort of 3 years that I spent researching that, and it's how I got into the actual more physical aspects of climate as well. So rather than just dealing with the consequences, I also got into the developing the climate models and actually using those to answer more sort of theoretical questions.
Wrapping up here, Chris Smith, activist Greta Thunberg just warned we've wasted 2 years now when we needed to act decisively to save a livable climate. And the next big climate conference in Scotland has been postponed due to the disease. And with the challenge of COVID-19 and a collapsed economy, maybe another 2 years could go by without any climate action. Do we have that time?
Yes. Yeah, so every year delay makes it harder to reach these stable climate targets. So, yeah, this, we're quite near the last chance now. So climate change, it's not a global existential threat. So humanity will survive, but, I mean, unfortunately, not everybody will. So, yeah, we are sort of really now talking, we sort of really need to take action. And as Greta Thunberg said, so 2 years of procrastination hasn't really got us anywhere. I think as awful and devastating as COVID-19 has been, we've actually been given a little bit of an opportunity here. We've been shown that economies can change overnight, or at least very quickly. May not be for the most desirable reasons, but we can sort of make these large-scale changes very quickly. I think people now appreciate working from home more. So one of the big changes we've seen was the reduction in transport emissions. So we had far fewer people driving to work. So this was a sort of big impact. This could be a long-term global lifestyle change, especially in the sort of global north. So hopefully people will see an alternative future, and one where there sort of might be less commuting-related stress and cleaner air, and sort of really think, yeah, I want that. I really want that. I want that for my children and my children's children. And that's, I don't know, maybe I'm being too idealistic, but I don't know. I think we possibly have been given sort of an opportunity out of really awful circumstances.
We have been speaking with Dr. Chris Smith, research fellow in the School of Earth and Environment at the University of Leeds in the UK. He is co-author of a new paper about the climate impacts resulting from COVID-19, and you can find links to follow up in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Chris, thank you so much for helping us out.
Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Be sure to stay tuned as we track this climate emergency and the developing world. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and for caring about our world. Listening to Eliza Gilkyson with her new song, With Peace in Our Heart.